Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
Happy Tuesday. I'm Stacy Ross here with Jake Heaps, DJ Wilder on the board. We have a fun show for you guys. Scott Service going to join us at 1 p.m. for the Scott Service Show. Plenty to ask the skipper about yesterday's game as well as the last several games for this team. And we're going to take a look ahead as well. We also have Jeremy Fowler joining us at 11:45. And the reason that Jeremy is going to join us at 11:45, Jake, is that he has a really interesting story about Russell Wilson. So this is really more of a report, a check-in, if you will, a little wellness check from Jeremy Fowler of ESPN. Jeremy Fowler on Sunday on SportsCenter said Russell Wilson was, quote, very happy with the moves the Seahawks made this offseason. Jake and I are torn about whether Wilson was really front of mind. Before I get to any of it, let me just tell you what Jeremy said. So he said, it started in free agency. I was told Russell Wilson was very happy with the moves Seattle made to get guard Gabe Jackson, tight end Gerald Everett. They got a receiver in the draft. And so, this is important, you guys, I'm told Pete Carroll behind the scenes heard Russell Wilson and understood his frustrations. So he tried to keep an open line of communication with him over the last few months. Jeremy says they didn't necessarily have a heart-to-heart or a sit-down or anything, but they were in steady contact. And then this other part's important. Wilson's beef was simple. Hey, we're not going to get to a Super Bowl anymore. I believe I can help us get there. I have some input. And so Seattle doesn't let players dictate terms for front office personnel. But according to Jeremy, Wilson's influence was definitely in place in this case. Jake, how front of mind was it? Because I have some issues here.
Oh, you have some issues.
Well, okay. not a bad issue, just kind of a question.
Yeah, I think that when you're talking about some of these statements that Jeremy Fowler has made and is reporting on, one, I think that there's a couple key aspects to this that he's really talking about, is that there was an open line of communication between Pete Carroll and Russell Wilson, that there was a heart-to-heart of some sorts. Look, Jeremy Fowler doesn't know if there was a sit-down or not, but that there was definitely conversation there, Stacey, that as they talked, that there was an understanding between the two of them as the frustrations that Wilson had and how they can go about fixing them and moving forward and to do that, whether it's personnel decisions, whether it's scheme, they came to a conversation and an understanding, so to speak, according to Jeremy Fowler. Then the other conversation I think is very, very important, because I think this got skewed a little bit, and partly due to Russell Wilson's own fault in terms of what he said to the media in terms of being involved in personnel decisions and conversations and things like that. People then took it as, oh, is Russell Wilson then wanting to become general manager? Is he wanting to basically be co-GM with John Schneider? And here, Jeremy Fowler talking about that there's never been a part where he wanted to dictate the terms of personnel moves, but that he had some input, had some thoughts, Stacey, had some notes, as you would say, that, hey, I just want to slip this note over to you, and hopefully you take my word for it. And in Russell Wilson's case, I'm sure he wanted it to be more than just a, I want you to really, really listen and hear me out before you shut me down or go in a different direction. And I think that that is important when you're dissecting exactly the details of what Jeremy Fowler is saying. And ultimately, Stacy, we'll get into it, but I think there were two moves that you could look at this offseason where the Seahawks did have Russell Wilson in front of mind.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious about hearing what you think those moves are. One of them we absolutely agree on, which is Shane Waldron. For me, first of all, let me say this. You didn't have to hear Jeremy Fowler, who is a fantastic, well-sourced reporter, say this per se about Russell Wilson. Russell Wilson, if you listen, if you read through the lines, has been pretty adamant that he wants to be part of the conversation about how to get to a Super Bowl, and he's frustrated they haven't been getting back there. So take a listen in cut number one. He talks about working with Pete and John to find the new OC.
Yeah, I mean, that's the hope, obviously, is me and Pete have been talking about it, John too as well, but just, making sure that, we get all the options possible and find the best person that can help us win Super Bowls. And not just win games, right? I mean, we've won a lot of games, right? But the reality is that, I think everybody in this call, we want to win more Super Bowls, right? And I think that's the fun part.
Now, whatever your feelings about Russell Wilson, whatever your feelings about this drama this past offseason, which seems to have very much calmed down, this is just a lingering report from Jeremy Fowler that Russell Wilson's happy about the moves. That's all this is. Whatever your feelings about Russell Wilson when this was going down, you have to admit that he's right there. You have to admit that the Seahawks, for all of their regular season success, one of the winningest regular season teams of the past decade, they've made like a very weirdly few amount of postseason appearances. And that ends with one of their best records in recent years and then being ousted in the wild card round to a like one-thumbed Jared Goff. So there is at least, whether you think it should be because, you know, Russell Wilson has input or not, a problem that needs to be solved here. So, Jake, I want to hear what you think about those two specific moves that you think are tied to Russell Wilson.
Well, obviously, number one, what he was talking about there was the conversation about the offensive coordinator and being a part of that process and being a part of that conversation in terms of not just talking about, hey, who are we interviewing and what do we think? It's, no, I want to be a part of the interview process. And Russell Wilson was a part of the interview process with these offensive coordinators. And eventually it narrows and gets whittled down to Shane Waldron. And I believe that move was made in conjunction together, Pete Carroll looking at Shane Waldron and saying, I believe that this guy has what it takes, has the it factor about him, has an offense that can best utilize and maximize the talent of my quarterback and the talent that we have as a whole on offense. Then you have Russell Wilson, who I believe looks at Shane Waldron's offense and is very excited about the opportunity to play in this offense in up-tempo, attack-style offense that it knows how to put defenses in binds in a variety of different ways. So that move to me, Stacey, right out of the gate, right out of the chute from the offseason, that was with Russell Wilson foremost in mind,
yeah.
Right? That, no doubt, was foremost in mind. The second one, which I think you and I can have a fun little debate on here, is Gabe Jackson. And the reason why I say Gabe Jackson was made with Russell Wilson in mind is that you couldn't have just signed any old offensive lineman this offseason. If they let the process go out and they don't sign Gabe Jackson, they don't trade for him, which, by the way, the reason why they had to is because the offensive line market just completely skyrocketed by the Seattle Seahawks. I think that they probably thought that the market would be a little slower and they could slow play it a little bit, and it happened a lot faster and a lot quicker than they were anticipating. But Gabe Jackson was the last, and it doesn't mean that it's not a good signing or a good trade, because I think it is. It just means that the last true impactful offensive lineman that would be a starter from day one that was available left out there was Jackson. And so you had to trade for him. You couldn't let it go to chance of him going somewhere else. You needed to trade for him. You were willing to take on that $9 million plus salary. You had to rework the contract, rework the extension, Stacey. But ultimately, you make that move because they knew they couldn't just go sign another Mike Iupati off the street, where he's coming off of his third, fourth team, he's injury-ridden, and they're trying to take another chance or another shot at revitalizing a guy's career for a year or two. They couldn't do that with another DJ Fluker or a J.R. Sweezy. They needed to get legitimate impact, and this was the guy that they had targeted. This was the guy that they needed to go get, and I believe that that move was made with Russell Wilson foremost in mind, because if they don't get that,
yeah,
and they get the last, they go third, fourth wave into free agency, Stacey, anybody that was upset of Russell Wilson and his conversation, I think that the conversation and the public perception would have shifted back to Russell Wilson's favor from a local and national perspective. Then you would have been like, oh yeah, this guy's got a definite point. How are you not addressing this position with a frontline player? And that's where I see Gabe Jackson, you know, being a direct influence on that.
I can see that. And they absolutely needed a guard no matter what. Technically a left guard. And I know that the topic is about moving Damian Lewis to that left guard spot, potentially having Jackson at right guard. Either way, they needed one. Mike Iupati retired. You had a hole there. So unless you had backups you wanted to go to, you had to do something. So I do agree that that was with Russell Wilson in mind. You had just four picks at that point and ended up having to trade one in order to acquire Jackson. That's got to be really tough to give up that draft capital. Hear me out, though. And this isn't a bad thing. Do not read this as a bad thing at all. But I also think that these moves aren't being made just explicitly with Russ as your front and center priority. If everything you were doing was solely to make Russell Wilson happy, you know what you would have done? Last year, you would have signed Jack Conklin and spent a ton of money on him. You would have signed Joe Tooney this year and paid him a ton of money, just like the Chiefs did. You would have been in on Harrison in the trade market from Oakland and acquired him. They didn't do any of that because also front of mind is the health financially long-term of their team and looking a few years down the road. And so while I think Russell Wilson is part of these decisions, and while I agree with you that Russell Wilson was a huge part of the hiring of Shane Waldron and Russell's input there mattered, I think that to be real, John and Pete, it's like a two birds, one stone situation. Russ is happy? Great. We've managed to make him happy and we're keeping him happy. But sorry, Russ, we're also going to be focusing on the financial health of this team. And that's why we're not spending $80 million on a guard. We're going to end up just having to trade one of our draft picks.
Well, and I do agree with you because look at the Kansas City Chiefs, right? As you had mentioned, the Kansas City Chiefs went out there and were extremely, extremely aggressive at addressing that offensive line position. They didn't just settle for one upgrade. They totally revamped their entire offensive line. The Seahawks chose to run it back with Ethan Posick, as it looks like as of right now, which, you know, all indications point to that they believe that he can improve in year two as a full-time center, and then they're upgrading the left guard position. So though that's the only move that they are making at this point in time, because they've got everything else running out. They've got Brandon Shell, they got Dwayne Brown, they've got Damian Lewis. So there's only two additions or changes that they could have made. They made one of the two, but ultimately, I think that when it comes down to it, as I said before, I think they were always going to be involved in the market. And I think they were very interested in a lot of targets that were out there that they felt like they could have gotten at a easier price point. For example, Kevin Zeitler, early on in the process, they were in on him. They ended up, you know, getting down to the final moments and they didn't want to go the next step down the road with the contract. Whether that was, we don't know, whether it was money or whether it was an extra year to that contract, they just thought that that wasn't worth it for a guy like Kevin Zeitler. There's more options. There's more fish in the sea. Mm-hmm. And they got all snatched up really, really quickly. But, Stacey, Gabe Jackson doesn't come at an easy price point. He came at $9 million. That's the most money that they have spent in an offseason on a single offensive line acquisition. So to me, that's no small potatoes when it comes to addressing the position.
Yeah, and I think it's really important that they did that. I had, just to clarify, someone texted in asking if I meant that they still needed a left guard. No, 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 no. What I was saying is they were in need of a guard after Upati retired, and it's important that they went and got Gabe Jackson. To Jake's point, Russell Wilson was a huge part of that acquisition. So we're going to be having, as a reminder for you guys, in 30 minutes, Jeremy Fowler, who had this report initially, who is tuned into what's happening with the Seahawks this offseason, what's happening with Russell Wilson and all of that stuff. He's the one that had this report on SportsCenter. He's going to be joining us at 11:45 to talk about everything he's hearing about the Seahawks offseason. Lots of great stuff in that conversation. And I might also want to fit in a couple extra questions looking around the rest of the league because there's a lot of NFL headlines this week. Before we get to any of that, though, it is 11:15, which means it's time for three questions brought to you by Tila Mortgage.
It's time for three questions.
Can't wait for it.
Every day at 11:15, three burning questions for Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
That's the dumbest question you could ask. What?
Well, the Mariners won last night. Good stuff, I guess. But, you know, young guys like Kelenic and Lewis and France had a big game last night, but the bullpen nearly blew it. Does a win in these types of games matter in the long run, or do you guys just care more about seeing progress from those young guys?
Good win, I guess. DJ, they snapped a six-game losing streak. They hit the ball. Yes. Hallelujah. I love seeing them obviously win. That's what you want. You want to continue to keep building a winning culture, and you got to be competitive. But more importantly, I just want to see progress from these young guys. If I could go on a six-game losing streak, as long as I could see Kyle Lewis, Jared Kelnick, any of these young players that you are seeing a part of your rebuild perform and continue to grow and perform well, I can deal with that. I can live with that. So to me, that's really what I care about when it comes to this season.
Yeah, I think that, look, I will complain. I know this isn't a saying. I'm going to make it one. I'll complain to the moon and back about losing games and about watching ugly games. It's not fun. It's not a great time. But I agree. When I am rational, the rational side of me, and I know you guys all have one too, the rational side of you is like, listen to me right now. You're in a rebuild. You're going to have bad games. What's more important is that there's a difference between May, June, and September in the play that you're getting from Jared Kelnick, from Kyle Lewis, and now in his second year, from Evan White whenever he gets back, from Ty France. Maybe Tramell gets back up here. There needs to be a positive, an improvement from May and June to September. That's what you're watching for. It's just, you know, maybe sometimes not as fun as watching for a World Series, but hopefully eventually.
Number two.
All right, after hearing Aaron Rodgers say his problem with the Packers has to do with their philosophy not picking Jordan Love, do you feel bad for him now?
Feel bad for Love or Rodgers?
Rodgers.
Okay.
I would say I don't feel bad for either one of them. Like, I really don't. I guess you'd feel bad for Love, but I don't, because what Aaron Rodgers said to me is an indicative or a shot at Jordan Love. As Aaron Rodgers said, look, I actually like Jordan Love. I don't have any problems with Jordan Love. I have a problem with the front office. So I don't feel bad for Aaron Rodgers. I don't feel like he's in this awful state of purgatory and that Aaron Rodgers is in the worst scenario possible. I just think Aaron Rodgers is extremely sensitive. I think that he is a big-time diva, and I think that when you're looking at what he had to say, there is a point to what he had to say, but at the same time, he's got it pretty good. He's got it pretty good in a lot of ways, and this organization isn't looking to move on from him in the next, you know, year, 2 years. And I think Aaron Rodgers is just looking at the situation and trying to drive his own ship, meaning that if Green Bay doesn't want him anytime soon, or if they want to move on from him, Aaron Rodgers wants it to be on his own terms, not Green Bay's. If he's going to stay a Green Bay Packer, he wants it on his terms.
Yeah. I don't feel bad for Aaron Rodgers at all. I mean, if it came out that, like, it was still, yeah, they chose Jordan Love and I was sad, I still wouldn't necessarily feel bad for him. I also don't think he's the villain. I do feel bad for Jordan Love in this situation. Like, you are going to have people who, you know, no matter what, it's going to be a tough job to fill in for Aaron Rodgers. Like, that's not going to be easy. And unfortunately, it sounds like you're not going to get Aaron Rodgers there to help you, because much like Brett Favre did with him, Aaron Rodgers still thinks he can play and he wants to be a starter elsewhere. And so he's not going to stick around and shadow someone and help him transition to the starting role, which who can blame him? So don't feel bad for anyone here except for maybe Jordan Love being in kind of a weird situation. But once again, you're a quarterback. In this case, you are a first round quarterback, and you got to be, you know, up to the task of filling in for that role. I am mostly curious to see how this continues to advance the narrative. And we're going to, at one, talk about whether or not this kind of conversation, when quarterbacks do this, goes too far. I wonder if at this point this was like nail in the coffin a little bit with Green Bay and Aaron Rodgers.
Number three.
We have some extra time here, so I'm going to veer away from question three here before I ask it. Someone texted in. We have some great sound to play in the timeline of Brooks Koepka versus Bryson DeChambeau, this feud, this high school level feud that they have. And someone's asking who wins in a cage match, Brooks Koepka, Bryson DeChambeau, or Brock Heward. I'll even throw Bob Stelton in there, but ooh, I just want to get your guys' take on
it. A boxing match?
Like a cage match.
You cannot throw Bob Stelton in there because he is going to win.
Okay, true. Matter. Okay, let's go with the first three then. Let's go with the first three.
Okay, my guy Brock is incredibly scrappy, and I think that he would also he would distract them by weirding them out about, you know, describing before they grapple, or while they're grappling, they're like, oh man, he's describing the other person's muscles and admiring, you know, their physique, and they'll be like, "What? What's going on? You're talking about my traps, my quadriceps," and then before you know it, Brock is pinning them down. If I'm going to pick anybody, I'm going to pick Bryson DeChambeau. That guy absolutely crushes the ball. It's like he turns that golf ball into dust. So I'm gonna pick Bryson DeChambeau.
I'm also gonna go with him. I think. Now, what kind of, is this a boxing match? Is it just all out brawl? Like
just
any rules
cage
go?
Match, so
cage
I think
match.
Any
I'm
rule
going.
Goes.
I will go with Bob here. I think that Bob literally has a podcast called "Get in the Cage."
Yes.
So
in the cage.
So I mean, in the cage. So this is, I mean, kind of his arena. Literally. And yeah. So I'm going to give it to Stelton. Take Stelton out of it. I think I'm also going DeChambeau. And yeah, I feel good about that choice. I think Brock is going to, he's going to do opposite. He's going to be this guy that's like 6'5", looks like he can like completely pummel someone, but he's going to be trying to make good and be like, "You guys, let's just talk. Let's just get along." Like, he's not going to be trying to fight.
Right. Before I say the real question three, since we still have some time here, I'm pretty sure Bob Stelton, his sleep number is in a cage, and that's okay. I think he's in an octagon. Anyways, question three. Which performer was more encouraging to see last night, Kyle Lewis or Jared Kelenic?
Honestly, I think it's Jared Kelenic. I mean, when you have Jared Kelenic coming up as a rookie in this league and struggling at the plate the way he has to start, it's always great to see good, positive moments for him. And you always wonder, is this going to be the moment where the light bulb comes on and Jared Kelenic then goes on a tear, goes on a roll? I don't think that's what you're going to see or what's going to happen. I really think that this is going to be up and down moments. And we'll get to this later, Jared Kelenic talking about the experience and yesterday before the game. And it really just comes to that, you know, visual that you're trying to drink out of a fire hose, that everything's just coming at you so fast. You're learning, you're processing so much. And already in 6-7 games, however many games he has played thus far, there's been a lot of learning. There's been a lot of learning, a lot of adjustments, mm-hmm. a lot of going through the process and having to learn and grow after experiencing so much success in his career, Stacey, that I think that Jared Kelenic, anytime he can have, you know, positive moments for him, it's very, very encouraging.
I'm going to go with Kyle Lewis on this one. I'm going to go with Kyle Lewis because he did slow at the end of his Rookie of the Year season, and it was still a fantastic season for him, but you were hoping that that wasn't a trend, that it was just maybe, fatigue, that it was some kind of cooling off period that would have, in a longer season, picked back up again, right? And so I think that when you saw him cool down at the end of last year, and then obviously, unfortunately, get injured in spring training and a little slow out of the gate, you were hoping he could shake off any of those issues. The more progress and the more good things I see from Kyle Lewis, I think the more confident I am that he can return to that form, and that whatever lingering issues were kind of at the close of last season were more of a slump than any kind of problematic trend for him. And so great news for Kyle Lewis. Either way, though, you guys, awesome to see that from Kyle and Jared alike. Did you see Curtis's text when he was like, the bat just sounds different. The ball sounds different coming off Jared Kelenic's bat. Like, it just sounds like a major league home run.
It's one of those things where, yeah, it sounds like a major league home run, but it just sounds incredibly, his swing and everything from his approach is just so incredibly smooth. The power, the transition that he has coming through that ball, I mean, it's incredible. And you know, you look at that home run, I think it was tracked at like 425 feet,
yeah, no big deal.
If I remember, it looked like it flew much farther than that. I mean, that ball was absolutely smoked.
All right, I need Mike Salk to explain a potential feud between two golfers. I gotta make sense of this. You know, I love a feud, but I need a bit more information here. He joins us next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Ross.
Joining us now is Mike Salk, brought to you by JAFCO Plumbing and Sewer. Mike, there's a feud and I need to know about it.
It's great.
Stems from, now I hadn't heard, I'd heard of both of these golfers, Bryson DeChambeau and Brooks Koepka.
Yes.
And I didn't know that they were feuding. But the other day there was a video of DeChambeau walking behind Koepka as he's being interviewed, and you got the deepest sigh, the deepest possible eye roll I've ever seen on anyone since I was in maybe seventh grade. I need to know what's happening with
these
two.
Yeah, it's taken the James Harden eye roll right out. Like, forget that one. That one's gone.
If you guys haven't seen it, it's viral. It's awesome. All over Twitter.
So first of all, DeChambeau is in Koepka's head. Like, Brooks Koepka should quit. Like, DeChambeau, rent-free, right in his noggin. It's awesome. Where's the feud come from? DeChambeau's weird. I mean, he's a scientist. He's a physicist. He's tried to take a completely different take on golf, right? Where he's started off with all of his irons being the same length, and he doesn't have a 6, 7, 8, 9 iron. He just has different degrees, and he uses all this math, and it's just a different, you know, it's an analytical approach to a game that hasn't necessarily had that level of analytics, and people hated him for it because it's different and it's new. Then he started winning. Right, he was the number one golfer in college, and he won a couple times in the tour. And then he decided that driving distance was the only thing that mattered. So he completely remade his body and had 27 protein shakes a day and got gigantic and started driving the ball 350 yards and leading the tour by 20 yards. It's crazy, which is fine. The problem is it takes him forever to do all of those things, and he's kind of, you know, a little arrogant about it, as he should be. Well, guys like Brooks Koepka, who hate golf, don't like it. Brooks Koepka's won 4 majors, fantastic golfer. By his own admission, doesn't like golf. Dude, he's the worst. I can't stand Brooks Koepka. I'm very much team DeChambeau.
Did I just become a Brooks Koepka fan?
Because he hates golf and plays it?
Yeah.
He stinks, though. You
and you
like
hate
him.
Yeah, you would. Are you sure I wouldn't like him?
I don't think
like
you'd
him.
Like him.
Okay.
I don't think
so.
I'll
do some research.
I mean, yeah, I don't think so.
But Saul, how is this? How do you react like this if you're Brooks Koepka?
It's terrible.
This is middle school, high school level drama and reaction. DJ, can we play the sound? Can we play the cut of that?
But it doesn't do it justice. It doesn't show the look of disgust in his face.
But you got to at least hear some of it.
Brooks, what were you able to do well and put up that nice number?
Just ball struck my way around this place. Didn't putt well, but I don't think many guys are going to putt well with this wind. It's very tough. I don't know what other guys have said, or I just felt it difficult to read. You know, sometimes. I lost my train of thought. Yeah, hearing that.
All DeChambeau does is walk by with his metal cleats. So there's a big debate as to what he's mad about. It might be that he was listening to DeChambeau talk about putting. It might, and then that made him mad. It might be that he was mad about the cleats, the metal cleats, the metal spikes. And it was like, dude, you don't need metal spikes. And that annoyed him. Some people have said that as he walked by, DeChambeau was like, hey, man, just put it on a line. And he's kind of right. Like, dude, you're out here complaining about how your putts are blowing in the wind. Like, get over it, man. You just got beat by a 50-year-old man. Like, I don't know. I think Koepka's nuts.
Oh, man, absolutely. I mean, I can't believe that he lost his cool that bad with an interview, but it is hilarious. It is truly hilarious. But, Saul, we have some great news. The Mariners, they ended their 6-game losing skid.
It's true.
I mean, like, hallelujah, and the bats came alive, and you got to see Kyle Lewis and Jared Kelnick, you know, hit some bombs. And guess what? Ty France is back in the lineup. Like, my goodness, it was nice to see.
Yeah, they needed that, right? They just needed to kind of break out of it. We had a lot of really good conversation about them today on the Brock and Salk podcast. It'll be out tonight. And, you know, a lot of this is sort of like, okay, well, you had some really difficult decisions to make. Anybody who thought that Jared Kelnick coming up was just going to like fix this lineup, it wasn't. It was never going to do that. And the idea that a 21-year-old kid with like 7 games above single A was going to just come up and fix your ailing lineup doesn't make any sense. So now how do you want to handle this? How do you want to handle Scott? How do you want to handle Jerry? What's the future for Kelnick? Gilbert's going to go tonight, I believe. Like, last 2 starts from him have been rough with a flat fastball that just looks flat and very hittable. So, you know, I'm concerned about it. It's more Gilbert, certainly, than
Kelnick.
What do
you do with him? Not to interrupt, but since we only have a couple minutes here. Like, say that he has a bad outing. What happens?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that you need to keep him up. I mean, if he's not ready, then send him back down with a specific list of things to work on. And, you know, pitchers are finicky. All ball players are finicky. Maybe there's something going on with an arm or an elbow or whatever. I mean, who the heck knows? You know, Ty France is a good example, right? He was crushing the ball until he got hit in the wrist, and then his entire everything went in the can. Mm-hmm. He comes back, and hopefully now his wrist is healthier, and guess what? He can hit again. Go figure. I mean, those baseball players are famous for playing through these injuries, and they can do it. Like, Ty France can go out and play But clearly he's not the same player. And in baseball, it seems like that just, especially with hands, wrists, fingers for hitters, it just ruins those guys.
It does. And you know, the only bad news that we talk about bringing up injuries is the fact that Yusei Kikuchi, after the sixth inning, started having some back issues, having some back spasms, and they're trying to evaluate how you talk about putting Logan Gilbert down potentially. They might not have an option, even if they felt like that was the best choice for him, because they might need him up.
Yeah, they might
with
need
Yusei
it.
Being out.
Yeah, I don't know. I look, there's always ways to get around problems like that. So they got to do what's – it doesn't. I'll say it again. It doesn't matter what happens in May or June of 2021 to your big league team. The development of Logan Gilbert is bigger than that. So if you believe that the right thing to do is to let him go through it here at the big league level, then leave him here and let him go through and work with him with the major league pitching coach and everything else. If you believe that the best thing for him is to have him back down in the minors and work with a different level and gain confidence or whatever the case may be, the last thing you want to do is say, well, we don't have Yusei Kikuchi, so we've got to have the future of our friend. No, leave him where he needs to be. You've got to make the decision based on Logan Gilbert's growth, not the needs of the spring 2021 Mariners.
How many pitchers do you potentially lose before you decide, like, okay, we got to do a five-man rotation? I don't see it happening. They seem very steadfast about it, but you're going to start having, like, two open days.
I'm hoping Marco's going to come back here at some point.
Should be
right?
End of May.
Yeah,
that's
right soon. That's in a few days. I mean, that's like a start away. Yeah. So I'm hoping you're going to see Marco back here, and maybe that makes up the difference. I just, you know, for all of the issues with the lineup and the way it was constructed this year, and there's some very real critiques and concerns there, they have really been bit with injuries a lot in the last month or so. When you start thinking Paxton and Marco and Margavichis, I mean, just those three alone. Yeah, that's a pretty big challenge to try to get through.
New Brock and Suck podcast tonight. What are you guys talking about?
A lot of Mariners, as I said. A little bit of golf. 50-year-old Phil out there with the win, the feud, etc.
Did you see that video of a kid, him asking a kid, like, what would you do here?
No.
I'll send it to you. It's good.
Oh, good. Oh,
okay.
I like that.
New Brock and Suck podcast drops tonight. You can download it at brockandsuckpodcast.com or subscribe to it wherever you get your podcast. It'll download automatically to your phone. He is Mike Salk, joins us every weekday at 11:30. Thanks, Mike.
See you guys tomorrow.
All right. Jeremy Fowler says Russell Wilson is happy about the Seahawks offseason moves, but I've got to hear more about this report, so why not bring Jeremy on to talk to us about it? He joins us next. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
Joining us right now on the Issaquah Pest Control Hotline, it is Jeremy Fowler, senior NFL reporter for ESPN. Hello, Jeremy. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Of course. We're actually so happy to have you. Perfect timing, because on SportsCenter on Sunday, you said you had a report, Russell Wilson happy with the offseason moves. Can you tell us a bit more about what you've been hearing specifically with that story?
Well, you know, I think obviously coming out of the offseason and what Russell said publicly, you know, there were some the team understood that they probably needed to get better in some areas. And even though, they, you know, they don't want to let players dictate personnel moves per se, but I think the influence was obvious. And so, you know, they made a few moves that, you know, from what I understand, I thought Russell thought was a good start. You know, you get Gabe Jackson from Las Vegas, the guard for protection. You get Gerald Everett, who's some think is a top 10 talent at tight end if he maximizes it. And then, you know, you get a receiver in the draft. So, you know, some pieces were in the works there. And, I mean, it's probably a long way to go. And you know, I think the relationship is in a better place than it was a few months ago, I think. Now, that probably has more growth necessary, but, you know, I think it's better.
You know, Jeremy, there's been a lot of comparisons between Russell Wilson and Aaron Rodgers, both players have been in battles or in, you know, in the public eye, have made their grievances out there. Aaron Rodgers dropping another nugget, another bomb, you could say, in the final send-off with Kenny Mayne last night. What do you make of Aaron Rodgers' situation in comparison to Russell's?
Well, so, you know, I do think they're different in that Rodgers' situation might not be fixable at this point. I think that's become pretty clear. You know, now maybe they work on a contract that includes more guaranteed money that shows Rodgers that, you know, Jordan Love is not going to replace him, that he's going to be the guy. Maybe there's some sort of public apology needed, but it just seems like the ties are pretty close to the result.
Sounds like we lost. Jeremy, are you there?
Oh,
looks like we lost.
Sounds like we lost Jeremy. We'll attempt to give him a call back right now. And Jake, I when we reach back out to Jeremy, I want to touch back with this same question, because even though people are hearing, like, why do I care what Aaron Rodgers is doing? When you talk about the landscape of the NFC, you know who's right there sitting near the top of it behind the Buccaneers and right in there battling with the Seahawks? It's going to be the Packers. And so you want to know exactly what's going on with Green Bay, and fingers crossed, hope that Aaron Rodgers lands with a team in the AFC, right?
Well, there's no doubt about that. But also it's a different dynamic when it comes to, you know, the power brokers of the NFL, when it comes to how much power can a quarterback really have in the NFL. I mean, Aaron Rodgers is going toe-to-toe right now with the Green Bay Packers front office and making no bones about it. I mean, he called them out specifically on national TV last night. You know, he loved his teammates, loved the front office, loved the fans. And so it's a very unique position.
All right. And Jeremy Fowler, we got him back. I think, Jeremy, you there?
Yes. Hey, sorry about that.
Oh, no worries at all. Let's just jump right back into our conversation about Aaron Rodgers. So, Jake, you want to go ahead and ask that question?
Yeah. Jeremy, just asking the same question again of how different are those situations, and when, where is Aaron Rodgers currently right now?
Well, I think they're similar in that some tension maybe had been brewing for longer than anticipated or that people knew. But with Rodgers' situation, it doesn't seem as fixable, at least with the front office and Rodgers. You know, there could be some ties there that are severed forever. I think with Russell, you know, he came out publicly and spoke about some of his, his concerns with the team and the direction of the Seahawks and wanting to get back to the Super Bowl and having some ideas of how to get there. I think, that was perceived as complaining, but he also was giving an olive branch, like, hey, I'm trying to be, upfront with this and let's work towards something. And then, I think with some of the moves they've made in the offseason, you've seen Russell retweet about the Seahawks and being excited for the season. So there seemed to be more encouragement there at potential solutions, where with Rodgers, his silence up until last night making those comments was really pretty much spoke volumes of where he stood with things, they're just, I've talked to a few people in and around the situation who think that this can get fixed solely because Green Bay doesn't want any other solution. They want to fix it. They don't want to trade him.
Yeah.
They hate the thought of trading him to a team where he might go win a Super Bowl and then they go 6-10, they don't want that. So they're not trying to think of any alternatives right now. And maybe they can solve things with a new contract with more guaranteed money that protects him so that he'll be the full-time starter for a long time. But even if they do that, there's still some broken ties in the front office and Rodgers that might be hard to mend at this point, harder than Seattle's situation.
It's a great distinction there, Jeremy. I know it's a very loaded question. Answered it great. There's been a lot of rumors, a lot of noise about Julio Jones. And as we get to this June 1st mark, Jeremy, a mark that you have highlighted in the past on our show, even specifically about a time frame that you could see a lot of veterans re-enter the market, or you could see a lot of action happening at that point. A lot of noise and a lot of conversation about Julio Jones being connected to a bunch of NFC West teams. Is that what you're hearing?
Well, the 49ers, I think, are at least having some discussions about it. I mean, any team with a need a receiver and more than, say, $15 million in cap space will at least look into this, The Patriots, I think, will at least talk about it. I know other teams I talked to are curious what New England might do there because they've had such an unorthodox offseason for their standards because they're so aggressive in free agency compared to what they usually are. So they're a bit of a wild card here. It's got to be a contender. I don't think Julio makes sense for anybody else who's not contending because he's really a two-year window at this point for a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And that's going to give teams pause, I look at a team like Tennessee, which I think would be intrigued by Julio, but they don't necessarily have the cap space or the cash desired to spend on a player like that unless he can rework his contract somehow. So, Arizona's been ultra-aggressive. I could see them doing something here. And then San Francisco, those are the two. And San Fran has, there are a lot of ties there that make sense with not only Kyle Shanahan, but some people in the front office there who were with the Falcons once upon a time. So could make some sense from that front.
I'm going to tell you right now, Jeremy, Seahawks fans do not love hearing that.
Well, you got your own top 10 receiver, though. If you can't
there, that, there you go. There you go. That's a great way to look at it. All right, Jeremy, we appreciate you taking the time, kind of last minute, but we really appreciate you taking some time out for us. Thank you so much for joining us. Great talk.
Hey, anytime. Appreciate you having me.
All right, bye. He is Jeremy Fowler, senior NFL reporter for ESPN. Good stuff, as always. A little bit of information there for you guys about where Julio Jones could land up. Hey, spoiler alert, he said it could be with the 49ers. That's not great. On what's going on with Aaron Rodgers and the latest with Russell Wilson and the Seahawks, sounds like that relationship is certainly on the mend. So we're going to keep this conversation going. Kenny Mayne's final SportsCenter broadcast included a revealing interview with Aaron Rodgers. For the first time ever, we got some clarification on what exactly has bothered him about the situation in Green Bay, and it'll surprise you. That's coming up next.